Welcome to the Brandy Gamer Podcast, episode 30, for September 9th, 2010. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm happy to have you with me as always. This edition begins a three-part series that I'm calling Gatherings of the Tribe, in which I talk to a variety of people about the big events that bring gamers together throughout the year. The Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, PAX in Seattle and Boston, E3, Comic-Con, Gamescom, Games Loop, Games Learning in Society, the list goes on and on. These events have proliferated in recent years, but the vast majority of gamers, and I'm sure many of you listening to this show, have never attended any of them, maybe because of where you live, or because it's too expensive, or in the case of a conference like GDC, you know, you're simply not allowed in. So I thought it would be useful to gather some folks together and chat about what goes on at these big events outside the typical press conferences and the announcements that tend to dominate the news cycle around these, you know, big get-togethers. So in this first edition, I speak with a couple of veteran game journalists, Gus Mastrapa from Wired.com and a variety of other print and online venues, and Chris Dahlin from Killscreen Magazine, and a variety of other print and online publications. In the next edition, which I'll post in a few days, I speak with two critics, bloggers like myself who write about games. And in the final edition, I speak with three game developers, each of whom regularly attend these big events as well. And you can look for all three of these shows to appear in the next week. So I hope that, you know, by surrounding this topic from a variety of points of view, we'll be able to discuss these gatherings of the tribe with a bit more subtlety and individual personality. I should also mention that we stray from the subject now and then. We discuss game culture, recent games we've enjoyed, and, you know, other stuff too. So I hope you enjoy this little series of shows. I've really enjoyed preparing them, and as always, I'm grateful to my guests for devoting their time to chat with me. So thanks for listening, everyone, and away we go. I am delighted to welcome two guests to the podcast, one a veteran of the Brandy Gamer Podcast and one first-timer. I'll introduce the first-timer first because it's just a real delight for me to have Gus Mastrapa on the show. I met him at GDC, the most recent one, which was weird because I had read his stuff for so long. I think, Gus, you might be the first gaming writer that I actually sort of became like enamored of.
Wow.
In the sense that I sort of associated your name with writing about games before I really understood what that all meant. And so here you are on the podcast, and it's a real delight to have you. Welcome.
What a great intro. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, just in case you don't know Gus, he's currently writing for Wired.com. He's also written for EGM and Crispy Gamer, Onion AV Club, Paste, X-Play, places like that. We were talking before we started recording that maybe we should list the places he hasn't written for, which would be a shorter list. But it's great to have you on, and we'll talk about Gatherings of the Tribe here in just a second. My other guest is Chris Dahlin, who is a frequent visitor to the Brandy Gamer Podcast. He is the editorial director at Killscreen. He's also a freelance writer, as like Gus is, with the Onion AV Club. Although you're not writing for them anymore, is that correct, Chris?
I'm in their orbit. I'm not writing for them. I'm sort of not writing for anybody right now while I'm so focused on Killscreen.
Of course.
But I still love many, many outlets that are kind to me.
And that would include Edge, that would include Variety, and the late, great Pitchfork. I was so sad to hear about that.
Well, you mean Paste.
Oh, no, I thought it was Pitchfork.
Oh, no, no, Pitchfork. Pitchfork.
Oh, my God. Oh, I had it wrong. Oh, wow. So Paste is gone, but Pitchfork is here.
Well, Paste is... they're not doing print anymore, but the site goes on, and they have a pretty active website. But it is unfortunate. Paste was the first magazine I ever wrote for that was print.
Gotcha.
And they had such a wonderful outlet, but yeah, the economy and everything, I guess, kind of took them down.
Well, if you're a loyal Pitchfork reader, just forget everything I just said. Because they're sticking around, and they're really good. So yeah, sorry about that.
Never die.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the show. And the topic, and we discussed this a little bit when we were kind of corresponding via email about what I was hoping to do with the show. The theme of these segments, and I'm doing three of them, is called Gatherings of the Tribe. And we're going to talk a little bit about what it's like to go to one of these major events where people get together. And that could be GDC, that could be Comic-Con, PAX, you know, all of these big conferences. And I know you guys have been doing those for years. And it occurred to me that it would be interesting to sort of hit this from various angles, from the point of view of developers who go, you know, for certain reasons, critics and, you know, people like me, bloggers, people who go for their own set of reasons. And then, you know, there's the kind of community of games journalists, which you guys have been part of for a long time. And really, I just wanted to be able to chat with you about your perspective on why you go to these events, which ones seem to you to be sort of most distinctive or most rewarding for you, you know, maybe how they've changed over the years, that sort of thing. There's no real, you know, set agenda other than to just kind of give people who listen to the show a chance to know a little bit more about, you know, what these are really like and what they're about beyond the kind of just standard issues of news that you get, you know, the latest breaking news from E3 or whatever that people read. I'm more interested in what goes on there and whether it's valuable to you, or if so, how it's valuable to you attending these events. Gus, why don't we start with you, and why don't you give me like a little rundown of some of the conference you've attended over the years?
Well, you know, my first gaming event was an E3. It was when I was an editor at Hustler magazine. And I convinced my editor to let me go to E3 and cover it. I don't know if I was going to be able to write a story for the magazine or whatever. But I went and I found a meetup of games journalists. And Simon Carless happened to be there. And that was like my first time meeting, you know, what passed for games journalists. At that point, I just kind of assumed that they were out there. Maybe I saw them on the 1UP show or whatever. But I thought that was kind of neat, and they were very welcoming, especially Simon. So I felt like, oh, here's something that I think I could do. The moment I met those guys and kind of for the first time got my press badge and did all that stuff, I said, hey, I could do this. I could come to this show and cover this, and that was kind of my first step into the business, was getting that first press credential, and then it's been, you know, every year. I've been come to these things, and it's almost like a constant stream of events. It seems like they just don't stop.
It seems like they've proliferated in recent years too. You look at the list of them; it's extraordinary. I mean, you could go to an event pretty much every month, and sometimes two or three a month.
Oh, and if you're interested in different mediums like music and fandom of any kind, you could almost be spoken for every weekend, I think. There's quite a bit going on. I know Chris and I, we met at Pitchfork, right? Was that the first time we met?
Yeah, the festival in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. So you know, music fests and things like that, I mean, they kind of are all booked over. But I always found that interesting that you know, that you and I had this gaming thing in common and like an interest in music in common as well.
Yeah, that was really nice. And they don't always overlap. I've always kind of made fun of the PAX, the music acts at Penny Arcade Expo. And that's really where you really have to draw the line. I don't know.
What's in it for you, Gus, when you go to a conference like E3 or GDC? I mean, you go for different reasons, I presume, but you're covering them. I mean, is it kind of a gig for you? Do you see it as just an extension of kind of what you do writing about games, or sort of there are other things happening there for you as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's the work, of course, like the things that you find and to write about. But I sort of feel like if you don't go, especially as a freelancer, to at least two or three conferences a year, you start to drop off people's radar. The people who hire you, the companies who, the contacts that you make there that help you get the games early and stuff like that, you have to be visible. And so I feel like that's part of my job, is getting out there and going there. And thirdly, these people who I admire, you guys and all these other game writers, since I'm kind of isolated, and I know a lot of us are, this is one of the few times that we actually get together. So I find that very valuable socially, and just, you know, kind of as a way of recharging and connecting with people who I like.
Yeah. Same for you, Chris?
Yeah, I find that, you know, when you're there, you're working and you're thinking that you should be out meeting people or making contacts. But one of the nicest parts is always hanging out with other journalists and other writers, because you know each other from different events, and it's just a nice way to keep in touch. You know, you see, you go to a game developer conference and you can see the different, as you say, the different tribes, and there's some good overlap and some good exchange. But it's like the other writers who know where you're coming from and kind of what you're dealing with while you're there.
Yeah. So give me a picture of what you do to prepare. I remember when I first saw Chris, I think the first time we actually got to meet in person was at GDC. And I just remember being struck by, you know, he was just a machine. I mean, it was like, I got to go to this and this, and I got this set up, and I'm going to go see this game, and I'll talk to this guy, and then I'm going to, you know, that you have to really like book your calendar in advance so that you get it all in. And it strikes me that it's almost like you have to set up a battle plan before you actually get there, so you got everything lined up ready to go. Is it like that? I mean, do you have to sort of make sure that you've got kind of all your ducks in a row before you kind of land in San Francisco?
You know, you look at some of the journalists, there are a lot of people who are there. I mean, their whole day is spent filing stories on different panels and different previews. And that's a lot more intense than anything I've done. I file a little coverage, but I'm not working it that badly. Gus, I don't know if you've done that kind of thing where you're there filing for some game blog and you're just filing all day. But I don't really envy people who have that gig.
No, it's hard. I made the rookie mistake. This is the first year I covered E3 for Wired, and I made the rookie mistake of booking solid. And when you book solid, you don't have time to file. So I had to cancel little gaps in between all my meetings so that I could run, file a story, and come back. That was the first time I'd ever done that. And, you know, honestly, as a freelancer, I'd kind of like written my own ticket before. I went, looked at stuff, and then afterwards I took, you know, I kind of pitched what I wanted to cover or used it as background. That's a much more casual, I think, way to handle E3. The people who are filing, you know, that stuff immediately. And, you know, for Wired, we only did two or three posts a day. There's other people that are on the hook for way more. So they actually get a limited view of E3, I think, when you do it like that. You know, you only see maybe like a fifth of what you could see if you're kind of running around as a free agent.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no serendipity. There's no just hanging around by the Indie Games Expo. There's less of all that. And I mean, you know, some of that coverage is amazing. I mean, Gama Sutra, who are of course related to it, just do excellent posts all day, but they work their butts off. And I've definitely had, you know, I always have a lot of plans going in, but I try not to take too many meetings. I've never had a really good meeting. Usually they're very, you just get some preview of some game. Often you don't even get hands on with it. I wrote one magazine feature after this GDC that was based on watching videotape for 20 minutes.
Wow.
And, you know, I got to talk to the creators and everything, but, you know, we were just watching videotape. They couldn't even say if the game is coming out this year. And I just wouldn't want to take too many of those kinds of things, because it's just discouraging. Or like another example, when I saw the Dragon Age preview at GDC 09, they wouldn't confirm if there were going to be dragons in the game. So you're kind of like, well, what am I here for? But at the same time, you get a chance to, you know, I remember having some great meetings with like just indie game developers where we're just sitting at the hall in Moscone, just sitting on the floor looking at their laptop. You know, I got to see Puzzle Bots and a couple other games that way. And, you know, just sitting with the creator of the game and there's no publicist hovering over you. And I'm not filing it that day. You know, I have time to follow up later or whatever. And that kind of stuff is wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Eskil Steenberg was doing that at GDC one year. He had his laptop out at a table and was just kind of talking to anybody who would listen. And that's kind of fun to bump into that stuff. But the meetings are very difficult, especially at GDC where there's two different pulls at GDC. You're wanting to see these panels and enrich yourself. And then all these PR people want to take meetings to promote their games. Kind of like, it's sort of like... they're piggybacking on GDC, getting opportunities for promotion. And sometimes those are hard to resist because it's a game that you think you could write about or something you want to see. But then other times, you know, I've made a mistake one year of booking way too many of those and then missed all kinds of panels that I liked. And so there's a lot of danger there to get lured into, oh, take a meeting with this person or this person.
Yeah. You mentioned that you want to attend things that may not necessarily involve you reporting on them, but just to sort of develop your interest in games. And as you think about GDC, what sort of talks or sessions tend to attract you? Why would you sort of go out of your way to see a certain talk as opposed to maybe going and having a meeting with somebody or seeing an early preview of a game or something?
Well, I think they're more frank. During the talks, the people are more frank about the process of making games because it's not meant as a promotional session. They talk about, and you know, one of the things is we see behind the scenes of movies quite frequently. We see how movies are made on TV. They make featurettes about it. But when we talk about the making of a game, we really don't see all that much about how it's really been made. What I love about GDC panels is you get a very, very tight view of sometimes a very specific element of a game. Like I remember one panel about the textures in Left 4 Dead and how they managed to cram all the textures into it so they can make the zombies look different. And that's just so enlightening and fascinating because it's a technical issue, but it's also very creative. And that's all GDC is. It's that for 3 days straight, which is just utterly fascinating to me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's we're really there to eavesdrop in a way. And it's funny how a lot of the press coverage that, especially the press coverage that people follow, seems to be the previews like, oh, here's what we just learned about Fable 3 or what have you. But most of the panels really are, it is developers talking to developers. And I think the ones that get accepted and the people who are up there to speak are there to share knowledge within the industry. And they can be a lot more candid. They can show you, you know, I went to a great AI talk once where that led off with Sims 3. You know, they're showing you the authoring environment that they use to program all the traits and the characters, all kinds of other things. Or like high level talks, like Soren Johnson did a fantastic talk on the difference between theme and mechanics and how the mechanics are what dictate what the game is about, and the theme may or may not have anything to do with that, and put it just really crisply and lucidly, and just made really informed a lot of how I thought after that. So, you know, just all these things, again, it's like you're really eavesdropping in on that. I've never been to E3 and I really haven't regretted it. Because it's just, I mean, it's not the kind of stuff I file as much. And it also just, you know, just another example, like the experimental gameplay session is always fantastic every year. They didn't hold it this year because I think they painted themselves in a corner because it was so excellent in 2009. The 10 games I saw in there were so much more interesting than any of the previews I could have seen. You know, this game about an RTS about time travel where the guy's explaining how you fight this war where you can keep traveling in time to like blow each other up with nukes when you're still in the Stone Age. And it just blew my mind, you know. I mean, it's like, that's what you want to see. Like, that's not something that ever would have occurred to me.
Yeah. I've always thought the GDC is this odd kind of collage of, it's charming in this way, but also in a way doesn't make sense to me that it's developers who are there to teach and learn. And there are these really cool sessions where, you know, you can really enrich your understanding of the design process, even like you say, you're from our sort of observer point of view. But then you've got, you know, there's a lot of announcements about games and a lot of stuff that seems very press oriented. And then you've got this kind of indie crowd, which have their own kind of space, and there's a whole different kind of energy about that, and it's covered differently, and it's people trying to get noticed. And then you've got all these people looking for jobs.
Oh, yeah.
And it's all at the same event. It's really interesting.
It's very weird. Like, you'll have that experience of being at a party and talking to someone who's just been working on this middleware company for 3 years and has no revenue yet, and they've bet everything on this thing. And you realize how many people are there striving one way or another, and you feel like it's sort of like this kind of mellow high school thing. Oh, there's Brenda Braithwaite again. You know all these people, and it just feels like so cozy because such accomplished people are just hanging out there. But underneath it all, yeah, it's like there's so much so much pressure and ambition, I guess. Yeah, and I don't want to say ambition in a bad way. It's a good thing, but
it's the only meeting, I think, where there's that kind of opportunity. You know, E3, you're not going to get work there if you're a game maker, really. I mean, I suppose you could kind of sneak away, and that's why they don't bring too many other employees to E3, because there's that potential for them to meet up with someone else. I mean, I think that's always kind of like a background concern with attending GDC and E3 for game developers. They don't want to lose their employees to other companies. But E3 seems like less of an opportunity because everybody's working. At GDC, some people are working, but most people are, just kind of seeing what's going on.
Yeah,
I'll be interested to hear what the developers you talk to, Michael, say about that. I've met a lot of people who are kind of the rank and file at game companies who don't go to GDC, and they don't have a chance to. If they did, it would be on their own nickel, which is like $2,000, and the hotel. They're not invited, or even companies in San Francisco might share a pass and you get to go for a couple hours. But it's like, we as journalists have such a luxury that you just walk in and you get this all access pass and you could just go to anything. It's you know, if you were a high up lead developer, if you were a senior developer at a major developer, you probably wouldn't have anything like that kind of access.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've talked to Manveer Hare on this podcast a few times, and he's recently, as you know, moved up to BioWare. And he, when he was at Raven Software, would sort of beg the people there, you know, to sort of send more people, because it was in his mind just a kind of a no-brainer. You would really, really learn a lot. You would meet people. You get a ton of ideas. You come back all energized. And they just couldn't afford it. I mean, they couldn't afford it. You know, just to send that many people, to sort of have that many people gone all at once when they're sort of, you know, either just about to get to crunch on a game or just emerging from it or whatever. But it just, you know, you see a company Lionhead or, you know, like the Media Molecule, and they're sending like the whole team, you know, everybody's there. And then other ones, they can't really afford to send more than just a few or maybe one or two.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder too if that's part of just a company philosophy. You know, maybe some companies think, you know, hey, this is where we're going to put a little bit of investment to help grow, you know, our influences. And other people think, or, you know, crunch time is just too heavy. They're like, okay, maybe if we get lucky 1 year and we're not crunching around now, we could send some people. But otherwise, you know, the game's got to come out.
Yeah. So, what's your take on E3, Gus? Were you pleased to see it return to its former glory?
I don't have much invested in it being big or small. I kind of quite liked the small one, the one in Santa Monica, because it was really easy to handle. You just kind of went to one place to another, saw the games you needed to see, and you didn't have to fight with other people. I quite like that. You know, my first 2, 3, 4 years of E3, I wasn't associated with any magazine. I didn't have many appointments. So I spent my time wrestling my way to get hands-on time with a game so that I could write about it for whoever I pitched it to. So sometimes that meant, you know, standing and looking at the back of people's heads for an hour until I got up there to play.
Yeah. How do you manage the balancing act between And I guess this would be for you too, Chris, but I'm thinking of E3 in particular here. How do you balance the kind of managed, arranged kind of stuff that you're asked to go to or see that's so clearly orchestrated very carefully and you know, to sort of get a certain kind of coverage? And how do you get sort of past or beyond that to find out more about a game that may not necessarily be apparent in the canned presentation that you're supposed to attend?
I'll be honest, that's a luxury that's very difficult to come by at E3 anymore, just because everything is so managed. You know, you take meetings, and when you sit down and have a conversation, unless you're on very good terms with the person, you're going to get a really well-exercised response. That's unless the person is kind of a wild gun. And those are the best. You always look forward to those interviews because you know they're going to say something interesting. But
have you had one of those? Have you found yourself in a situation where somebody's kind of unloading and you weren't expecting it to?
Well, I just interviewed Peter Molyneux, not at E3, but just recently, and he's a pretty frank man, and he likes to talk about all kinds of things. And he's very interesting to speak to on multiple subjects and is willing to talk about anything. So I found that very interesting. But it's always disappointing when you go to a place like E3 and you start talking and you could tell that it's just kind of you're getting the recited answers. So that's something that's really, really, really tricky. You know, you got to figure out ways to find something interesting. And very often I'll just take a whole interview and just, you know, put it on my computer and never transcribe.
Yeah.
I had one. I had a case where I was talking to someone who I never ended up using the interview. I kind of took it, but it wasn't a good fit for The Onion. And we talked for an hour about this game that he was working on. It was a pretty interesting conversation. And I turn off my recorder, and then he just spills everything about how terrible, basically, effectively, how terrible it was. And I'm like, well, you know, for my own edification, that was cool. Although it's funny, sometimes you can see, you know, again, the frankness of GDC panels. I met Richard Garriott at a meeting because NCSoft was showing whatever game. And I was just like, man, Richard Garriott, because growing up, the Ultima games were, you know, my thing. And he was fantastic. And I'm like, oh, this is so cool. Well, then later that week, he gave a panel about the problems that Tabula Rasa had gone through in its life to date. This was even before it shipped and failed. And it was very apparent from listening to him talk just on his own power that you could just see, like, oh my God, this guy's not a good producer. This guy has genius in all these ways, but I can just see all these problems just from what he's telling us out point blank. And, you know, yeah. It was just very revealing. So I don't know. Sometimes, they're developers, you know, it's like some people are very good at sticking to a script, and some people really just want to talk, and maybe they just talk about process, but just from them talking about process, you can glean a lot of things.
Yeah. After you've been around the block a few times and you've looked at a lot of games, are you able to tell when a game is going to be a disaster sort of before other people see it? I mean, when you're, have you sort of picked up a little bit of savvy about sort of seeing the actual end product before other people have seen it in preview? Or have you found yourself to be sort of drastically wrong about a game? It turns out to be tremendous and you expected it would be a disaster.
You know, my gut's usually right as far as, you know, what I think is going to be interesting. I kind of hear early buzz about it and then I go... you know, you can always tell a game is going to be a disaster if you see it E3, 4, and 5, and 6 years you know, in a row. But, you know, one of the things, you know, the tribe element you're talking about, a lot of things we rely on, especially when I'm at E3, is my run-ins with other journalists. And what have you seen? You know, ask really quick. And if somebody's raving, I remember one year, everybody was raving about Guitar Hero. You got to go see this thing. You got to go see this thing. Because it was really not on anybody's radar at that point. And if it had been, my gut would have been, it's just like Guitar Freaks. You know,
yeah.
That's not going to be interesting. And, you know, how wrong would that opinion have been? I mean,
yeah. What about you, Chris?
I think I get suckered into the, I'm glad I don't do more previews because I always want to believe that things will work out. And, you know, not even just in particular games, but, you know, I was thinking back on GDCs I'd been to, probably not as many as you, Gus, but, you know, from 2006 on, the kind of things that were really interesting that people were really on fire about, you know, 06, I remember Second Life was huge. I went to a wonderful party for Second Life and had a great time. And I'm like, oh, Second Life is so neat. They throw great parties. I'm going to write so many stories about this. This is wonderful. And, you know, that didn't pan out. 2007, I think, was the year with user-generated content. And that didn't really fly the way they thought it might. You know, every year you can kind of see the things that people are so revved about, and then a couple of years later, you sometimes you're lucky enough to hear a panel or meet someone and hear how it just didn't pan out and why. But I don't know. It's I still kind of like that energy. I like when people are that inspired about something and really shooting the moon on something.
Yeah,
and it's funny because you know some of the people who speak at GDC, like some of the regulars. They have their ups and downs, and sometimes you see them when they've just shipped something amazing, and sometimes it's been 10 or 15 years, and you know, it's just neat to see that arc and kind of learn from what they've learned.
Oh, there's an interesting narrative there. You see these game designers who, at a pre-E3 event, the gentleman who was one of the first designers on the Driver games, you know, they kind of trotted him back out because they're launching a new Driver for I guess Ubisoft is doing it. And man, the narrative of that guy's life, from making games in the 80s to disappearing for almost, you know, 15 years from game design and then coming back, I'm fascinated by that. Like, where did you go? I guess I asked him, and he had been doing, you know, he made two or three other businesses in between, and then, you know, kind of came back. Maybe because the franchise, somebody wanted to revive it, and they said, well, let's call this guy because, you know, he was involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm struck by the way that every culture has its rock stars, you know, that I remember the first GDC I went to. I can't remember who first mentioned Clint Hocking to me, but I was trying to decide which talks to go to, and, you know, I was told you absolutely got to go to Clint Hocking's talk. You can't miss that. That would be a disaster if you missed it. And I remember going there, and it was like this little rapture, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, people were just, and these were developers primarily that really were there to sort of like get the message, whatever the message was going to be. And my experience of conferences at that point have been mostly, you know, academic conferences where people are delivering papers, you know, and, my God, he starts talking and it's just like, strap in because here we go. And he was trying to fit like a 3-hour talk into, you know, 50 minutes. But it was an interesting environment, I thought, because you could tell that these people, for the most part, most of them in the room were really just trying to figure out like, where is the next target for us? Where are we going? And here was a guy who was going to suggest his vision of where he thinks we need to go. And they were on the edge of their seats, man. I mean, they were really right there.
I think there's this feeling, especially at GDC, that the soul of video games and of game design is it's contested territory. And there's different ways that we can make games, and that there's different reasons we can make games. And so a lot of times you see these talks, you see Will Wright talk, you see the guys at the Indie Game Rant, they're passionately arguing for their view of how games should be made and why they should be made and what they should be about. And so that's fun to see. It's like being at the Continental Congress.
Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You're watching people try to write the history of games.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, you reminded me, Spore was the biggest one. That was the one where his keynote, Will Wright's keynote in 2006. And, was so inspirational, and I was like, oh, this thing is just going to change human civilization. And and to be able to see it full circle to 2009, where I heard the wonderful Margaret Robertson give her talk on how it was more about how the science of the game failed, but it was really about how Spore failed. And I was like, oh, look, I've come full circle hearing these wonderful people speak about both how great it'll be and how bad it was, and I'm gaining something from either of them. You know, you reminded me too, though, of about rock stars that you mentioned earlier about the indie community and how that's really become a vital part of the conference. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons for it. IGF is very important. Simon Carlos, among others, is very passionate about that scene. And so they're very visible, but it's funny because as a component of a conference, a lot of them are, you know, they're very young. A lot of them are terrible speakers. Some of the people who are making the really exciting games will be up there, and it's, you know, the indie game rant this year was sort of kind of goofy. Last year was was often a train wreck. And it's part of the charm. And when you think of it, it's like, what I take from that is that, you're seeing the scene and there's this vibe of love and everything like that. Maybe later they'll be able to better share their experiences. Kelly Santiago, for example, has turned into a fantastic speaker and has really been able to communicate the journey she's been on. But, you know, GDC is what makes me think of them as punks more than anything else. It's not that they're coders. It's not that they make these games. I mean, there's their happy little games. You know, they're coders. They're people who, if they weren't doing this, they could get a job at a bank. You know, they're not living on the edge that much. But the fact that the vibe I get from seeing them and seeing them around is almost like they make it look really easy in the way that if you were in New York and you saw the Ramones, you'd be like, you know what? I have to go start a band. Because if these guys can have a band or the Replacements can have a band, they're fucking drunk all the time. Like how, if they can do this, then it's like, you're not even taking away from their talent. You're just thinking, oh my God, this seems so easy. You know, this seems so easy to do. I have to go do this. It should be my mission in life to go do this. And I always get that kind of bug around them. And you realize that there's more to it, that there is a genius there, this faculty they have for making these wonderful mechanics and these wonderful complete experiences. But it just makes it seem like, why the hell aren't you doing this?
Yeah.
They're also, appealing as well. A lot of these, many of these indie game designers, there's something kind of attractive about them. I don't know what it is. It's about the way they carry themselves, the way they've graduated from coder to cool kid. you know what I mean? I just find that really appealing. There's something kind of sexy about a lot of these young game designers. And I don't know how it is that they kind of separate themselves from that. But it kind of makes them a little bit easier to grasp onto. Whereas, you know, you go to another game design, you know, like an established game developer, and the people are, you know, they're like people that work at an office.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember your piece about Epic was like that. They use PowerPoint. They have to communicate in a corporate setting because that's how they make their ideas happen.
I think the only difference is like they're at an office that where they let you put Spawn action figures next to your computer.
Well, how cool is it too when you go down to that IGF little ghetto, which I keep hoping GDC will expand or make somehow more accessible, but it's just become such a logjam. But I mean, how cool is it? You're down there, you're looking at these guys, and they are still primarily all guys, and they've spent however long making this thing, and there may be a team of 1, 2, 3, 4, and you walk up to the thing and you watch people discovering this thing, this game for the first time, and the guy that made it standing right next to you.
Yeah.
And you can talk to him about it, you know, and he's clearly proud of it. He's also trying to sell it. He's also trying to get attention. There's a lot of stuff going on, but there are people watching you play and watching you discover it. And it's just a certain kind of interactive kind of environment where I can't think of a parallel to that. Theater and film and other kinds of things we do, we don't let people in until we're done. But here it's almost like you're seeing this thing in its infancy in a way. And you can praise the guy right there and kind of like you want to just put your arm around him and say, dude, you are so awesome. This is fantastic. I'm kind of struggling to describe it, but I've never been in that situation before.
I think historically games just have been, the creators of games have just been more accessible for whatever reason. You know, the story of the first QuakeCon is they got together and they played Quake and then Carmack came out and hung out and talked with them, for the rest of the night about games and about, you know, how Quake was made or whatever. You don't go to a Rolling Stone concert and then get to hang out with the Rolling Stones unless you're really lucky, you know.
Yeah. And they're not like playing their record and saying, well, what do you think of this? And like, what do you listen to it? Does this work? We're only halfway through this. Do you think we should change this part? No? Okay.
Well, let's shift the conversation a little bit to other events. Did you both attend PAX in Boston?
I skipped it this year, sadly.
Okay. Gus, you were there, Chris. You've been there before, though, Gus.
I thought you were at PAX East this year.
I was at PAX. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I thought you were talking about this weekend. Yeah, I was at PAX East.
I see okay. so many conferences, and I was starting to think I was just hallucinating.
So, I read about PAX, the Seattle version, and you know, it seems like a certain kind of madhouse, but people also seem to really have a good time. How is that event different? And if you've been there more than once, sort of how has that evolved? People who, I think there are a lot of people who'd love to go to PAX and just simply can't, game fans and stuff.
That's actually,
No, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's too bad if they can't. I mean, I think it's still pretty reasonably priced. If you can get to town, you can do that. And that was really bright of them to open it on the East Coast as well. I've been twice. My first one was in 2007. I went to Seattle, and it was really kind of a spur of the moment. I mean, I just had some, it was not an industry event. It was almost more just like a vacation. There were press people there, but not a lot. I saw a preview of Far Cry 2. Well, a panel on Far Cry 2, but that wasn't, you know, the biggest deal in the world yet. It was very much a geek sleepover. I mean, you'd hang out. You could get into these panels. There were like small rooms and really niche things. Like I heard a great talk on how to publish a collectible card game. And it was utterly fascinating. And I don't ever plan on publishing a collectible card game. But, you know, at night they had the concert, but they also like they would screen like Tron, and a bunch of people would just be sitting there at 11 p.m. watching Tron. It was very mellow. The one press thing I did was Wizards of the Coast was having a press event at a bar, and I went over and I was the only journo there. And we were just talking about Battlestar Galactica and drinking on their dime for part of the night. So it was a really wonderful, I left with a really positive impression of it because it was a very mellow, very pro fan, pro gamer community. If you were press, like I cut a line once with my press pass and someone gave me shit about it and I didn't do it again the whole weekend. I was like, this is not the ethos. There was no creepy, hey, look, there's a girl kind of vibe going on. There was nothing like, you know, people were very, very mellow, and it kind of exemplified all the good values that come out of that strip. And, you know, PAX East, by comparison, I think still had most of that. I went to one panel, the Pitch Your Game panel, where some pretty creepy people were coming out of the woodwork. And, you know, some of the vibe was worse. It was definitely much more crowded, and that was a logistical problem that they just hadn't counted on the number of people who were going to be cramming into that space and how sweaty and hot and awful it was going to become. But it was still a great fan event. You know, I mean, there were some game previews, but it wasn't too bad. There was a big event for Red Dead Redemption, but, you know, but at the same time, like one of the big events all weekend was the Interactive Fiction track. And that's about as niche as you can get. It's a little bigger in Boston because it's still the spiritual home of it. But, you know, it was still very much a fan event, held up pretty well. It's definitely bigger. And I heard that PAX Prime now, a friend of mine was just remarking that it was almost more like E3. And when you saw all the press that came out of it and all the game announcements and the Duke Nukem Forever and Jonathan Blow's game and all these things, definitely it's definitely turning into like a must-go thing for the press, I suppose, which isn't what I used to like about it, but, you know.
Yeah, I try really hard not to take any meetings when I go to PAX. I try to treat it like a trip for my edification, but it's really difficult, you know, to go there and have this opportunity to see a game and not take it, especially if you know you may not get another chance before it comes out. So last year I tried really hard to just kind of go and have fun and wound up working a bit. And that's a little disappointing because it becomes like a vacation where you keep getting pulled away to do this other stuff. That's, you know, you're like, I'm wasting time here writing when I could be hanging out with people playing a board game.
Yeah. But I wish I could be in the room with the organizers of the whole event are clearly grappling with the size of it.
Mm-hmm.
and that it's grown into this amazing thing. And so do you then say, look, we need to cap this just so that it's, I mean, I've seen pictures of the Seattle event where people are just lined, you know, with no hope of ever even getting into the venue, sort of at event after event there. And that, it upset some people apparently, but then other people are like, we'll just go to something else. Is it gotten too big? Does it help that there's two East West Coast going on that sort of helps keep it organized? Does it even matter?
I don't think you. I mean, I can't fault them for getting big, because that's, I mean, God bless them. You know that they're that successful. The one disappointment really was just that it was hard to get into panels. And I think if they could find a way, and those rooms were huge, and it really was at the point where like someone could have given a panel on like which side of the plate to put your fork and which side to put your knife and your spoon, and it would have been full an hour ahead of time. And I don't know what you can do about that, though, because I don't know what you can do about that except have stadium rooms for every single thing that anyone does. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely a different vibe. I mean, it's been a continuous thing since they had, what was the first one? They had like 100 people in a room and they were all playing games. And afterwards, no one stole any of the controllers. All the controllers were still there. And that's how they knew they were onto something. So, you know, I don't know. I can't fault them for getting bigger. It's a different vibe. And I guess they have to find other things that fit a crowd of tens of thousands of people.
Yeah.
What I find fascinating about this show is I didn't realize this, but there's a whole segment of gamers who had never connected with the culture of fandom before. They hadn't gone to a science fiction convention or a gaming convention, like a board gaming convention or something like that. And so for a lot of kids, this is their first experience with that particular culture. And it's like life-changing. You hear these kids talking about it. About how I didn't realize there are this many people that were like me, or I didn't, you know, realize that if people got together, we could have this much fun. And I find that fascinating and really cool. And also, you know, like our generation, I don't know about you, Chris, but, you know, I grew up, I went to a Star Trek convention when I was a kid, and I went to, I don't know, some other kinds of conventions. So I kind of had a feeling for that. But with gaming, for whatever reason, QuakeCon and maybe some lands and stuff like that, this particular flavor of get together it just didn't occur to anyone.
Yeah. I think journalists in other media or in other sort of segments of culture it's inevitable that you get kind of jaundiced. You know, that there's, it's just, you get worn down or whatever. You used to get very cynical and it just strikes me that you guys going to PAX, I mean, that it's just really a fan thing, that it's maybe you'll be able to report on something. But I mean, I get the sense that you're still kind of a fan, that you still, that part of being a gamer still appeals to you.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's you know, we live solitary lives mostly, you know, we have our families and we, you know, we're lucky if we have a group of people that we can get together with. And the great thing about PAX and E3 and all these different things we talk about is it's just an opportunity to get together with people, where you all speak the exact same language. You don't have to edit at all. You can actually talk about things you've been waiting a year to talk about. And that's, you know, just to be able to do that two or three times a year, most people never get to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm starting to realize more. I'm in New Hampshire, but I'm kind of near Boston. And I'm starting to see more and more of the scene down there and see how it is becoming an amazing scene. So I'm not feeling quite as isolated. But GDC is still, PAX is fun too, but like GDC is still such a central event in my year now in such a weird way. It's actually, I think I was saying to you earlier, Michael, that like a lot of people have those high school anxiety dreams where they're back in school and they didn't take or whatever. I don't have those anymore. I have GDC dreams, and they're always, I'm in San Francisco and I'm in the wrong place, or I'm at a boring meeting, or just something else has gone wrong. But it's like, I have those regularly now. It's kind of fucked up.
Yeah. Do you both agree, or maybe you see it differently? Is GDC the must go to event? Is that the one you can't miss?
That's what I tell people. That's what I've been telling newer writers, especially ones who have heard more about E3 or maybe because of the outlet they're writing for, that it's like they have to go there. And I always try and say, you know, GDC is the one where you really want to go, because there's just more serendipity and there are going to be more weird, interesting things you're going to run into there than at one of these other things.
You know, I tend to, if you're a populist, I think PAX is definitely the one. If you're interested in the people who game and the love, I think PAX is a really great experience. I think for non-gamers particularly, but and for journalists too. But then if you're interested in stroking your beard a little bit, getting enriched, and, you know, I think some people aren't interested in how software is made. They like games, but they're not interested in the coding problems and the different difficulties. And so I think there's probably some journalists who don't find GDC as interesting. I do, but I can see how there would be a segment who are like, I'm interested in your game. I'm interested in how you made it, in that, you know, maybe it would give me more enlightenment around how cool the game is, but they don't really care about the process. So I can understand where, you know, GDC could be a dud for some people.
Yeah. So are there events that you've been to that are kind of off to the side, smaller events, the ones that don't get all the coverage, that have been interesting to you? I know, Chris, you had recently attended the event in Boston that sort of struck me as interesting.
Yeah, I just went. Darius Kazemi and Scott McMillan have been organizing Game Loop in Boston. It's mostly the Boston area people, but we get some people I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Borat Pfeiffer came in this year. And other people come from like the West Coast or Canada sometimes and swing down. And it's basically 100 or 200 people at an unconference, which if I only just really learned what an unconference is. It's basically self-organizing. It's everyone just gets together at the beginning of the day, fills out a whiteboard with things they want to talk about, and then it turns into sessions. And
so there's no preset program or anything? There's
none at all.
It all happens sort of spontaneously.
Yeah, exactly. And someone will look and say, hey, there's an opening. And they'll say, hey, I want to do a panel on this. And if there's some interest, someone just kind of steps forward to moderate it. And the sessions turn into kind of one of two things. One of them is like an informal tutorial. So I went to one talk where I heard about Inform 7, which is an interactive fiction authoring program. And for a 1 hour talk by someone who had kind of just thrown it together, someone who knew the program, it was really fascinating. It was enough to kind of get a sense of how the thing worked and why I would want to use it, and to get kind of inspired about it. So you've got learning opportunities like that. And then you've got basically kind of bull sessions where people kind of sit around and talk about narrative and games. And it's fun to sit around and talk about narrative and games or whatever topic. So it was a really interesting way to do it. I like the format. I understand better how it works. I think it helps to go to one, because then you understand a little better the next time how to make something out of it. It was also good for the scene, because again, Boston, I think, has been off the radar for a while. Like, you know, there have been a couple well-known companies there, but to see so many people from like the big studios and also from the indie studios all hanging out at this event, and getting a chance to talk to each other and then get beer afterwards was good for the area. It was a good, exciting day. It came together pretty well. And I think it's the kind of thing that's easy for another city that's not San Francisco or not New York City could take advantage of something like that. Right. They wouldn't have to trump up this thing. They wouldn't have to be trying to set up a mini GDC or put all this money into it. You could just get a bunch of people together in a space and have a really meaningful time.
Right. And it was pretty well attended, clearly.
Yeah, it grew. I think it was under 100 last year, and it was just under 200 this time, and probably be bigger next time.
Do you think there was a lot of students there? Was that part of the population, or was it mostly designers?
You know, it was funny, actually. They didn't have a lot of, I didn't meet a lot of students there. It was definitely a lot of people who were already in the business somehow. Okay. And I think if they spread the word more, they'd be able to draw that in.
Yeah.
So you saw like a lot of people from Harmonix, a lot of people from Irrational, a lot of the big indies in town like Deja Bond and Firehose. But that's really interesting. Yeah, there weren't a lot of people trying to, I didn't see a lot of people who were like trying to break into game design, and it would have been an amazing opportunity for those people to get in there.
Yeah, because I think about those programs that are out there and all those kids that are working like at the MIT program and things like that. Like, what a great opportunity to talk on that level.
Yeah, totally. We did have people from Gambit there, okay. But that's more of a graduate program.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
What about you, Gus? Have you been to a smaller conference that you would find especially notable?
Well, for me, one of the ones that I was thinking of, not necessarily a conference, but there was a period when I was covering competitive gaming, that beat. And so they have competitive gaming events all over the country where the teams get together and play, you know, Halo and Guitar Hero and Quake and all these different things against each other. And I found that really fascinating because they have their own community of journalists who are virtually unknown to the rest of the industry, to the rest of games journalism, because they write to such a specific and narrow audience. And I found it really, really interesting to meet those guys, see how they did what they do. They're on the outside, really. I mean, they're not really known to the game companies, and if they are, it's sometimes an antagonistic relationship because these are
sponsored and stuff, right? They have the sponsors that, you know, that's part of the whole thing, is that they are paid to travel around.
The game players are, yeah, they're sponsored, but the guys who cover the competitions and call the competitions, you know, they're usually hired by the company that's like running the events. But what's interesting is the games are old, right? So like at QuakeCon, I didn't go to QuakeCon, but I went to a bunch of SDVG events. You know, they're not so interested in buttering up the press because they're not going to sell more copies of Quake around it or whatever. So it's a different relationship. And I found that really, really neat. And secondly, I really got turned on to what competitive gaming is about. These guys are really good. And the narratives that occur, the sports narrative, you know, between two people competing, I found just as fascinating as baseball or football, which I'm not really that big of a fan of. So the first time I saw somebody play StarCraft 2 or StarCraft 1 live competitively, I was kind of won over. And that's something I kind of recommend a lot of journalists to check out. We're missing a big opportunity there when we kind of dismiss competitive gaming as sort of sports, things like that, because the stories and the characters there were just wild.
You know, it's funny because I wouldn't say I've dismissed it personally, but I know what you mean. It's like just sort of this invisible thing, and you and I've talked about it a little before too, that you know, they tried to put it on the air and it didn't really work that one time they put it on CBS. And I wondered, what do you think would help people understand it and get interested in it, both journalists and maybe the wider public?
I think that the wider public's always going to be a tough sell. I think that the one opportunity that we had, which is World of Warcraft, which is a game that, you know, 10 million people were playing simultaneously, was a missed opportunity, mostly because it's a very technical reason that it was very difficult to spectate that game. Mm-hmm. They couldn't put an additional camera in there to create the kind of spectating that you need to make sports work. So that was a technical reason. Otherwise, that was the big chance. You know, of course, we know that in Korea, StarCraft, just because of the amount of people that play it, and they've developed a way to tell those stories on television in such a way that they're very compelling. I don't know how it's going to work and if it'll ever will work. I mean, poker got on television, and that's a terribly dull game, and it takes a long time for the drama to really develop. And games for me seem like you can tell a story there, and the personalities are very interesting. I think it's a matter of just somebody finding the right fit, the right game, the right group of people playing that game, and it could work. But I don't think anybody's willing to do it. There's too much money already been blown on it for it to happen.
And the right producer, and maybe it was that CBS broadcast where they had four judges, and one of them was this excruciatingly hot lingerie model, and she was the scoring judge. and you know, the game keeps score. So it was sort of
was that for the Guitar Hero competition?
Yeah, yeah. And you pointed out, I think there is a little more to it because some things are harder than this. But it was still, it was just sort of like, this is sort of embarrassing. Whereas if you had like the right person who was just 100% in it for the game and for telling that story, I could see how they might pull it out.
I think it may mean, you know, some game company starting from the beginning and making a game that's intended to be a spectator sport. That may be what it's going to take.
Mm-hmm. You know, which would be a good strategy.
Yeah, I mean, if Valve decided, hey, we're going to make a game that people are going to watch on television and put their weight behind it, they could probably figure it out.
Yeah. Something like what's that, you know, any of these things, the Hunger Games or Marathon Man or any of these like survival of the fittest, where you just watch these people fight for their lives. If you had a roguelike but put it on TV, so everyone was just like dying to see would this particular hero make it to the end, and then they fuck up and everyone at home is just like, oh.
Well, you know, I think there's people like to watch it live too, that there's a big difference if you're in the room. We did a couple of years ago at the end of one of the courses I taught, I let the guys choose what they wanted to do, sort of to kind of just blow off some steam. It's like finals week, and they chose Halo, and they decided to have a tournament. And they said, hey, is it okay if we just have our friends come and kind of let it be known that we're going to be in this big room doing it? And I said, sure. And I mean, you know, we had probably 150 people show up to watch. It was insane. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, sorry, I heard a little clip.
That was me, Claire. You know, you reminded me, actually, one of the wonderful things about PAX that I just didn't get into this in didn't get into see it this time, but the Omegathon, where they have 16 people eliminate down. Seeing people play Jenga competitively is excruciating. And the year I went, Halo 3 hadn't come out yet, but it was the final game. And it was down to two people playing Halo 3 against each other on a map they'd never been on before, with weapons like the flamethrower that they totally screwed up on and had never tried. And they were playing for a shot to go to the Tokyo Game Show, all expenses paid. Yeah. And there were 2,000 people watching them, and it was absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy. But there's something to be said for the most everybody in the room has played that game and they're familiar with it. And they're sort of invested in it in ways that maybe you wouldn't be in other settings, you know?
And even if you haven't played it, it's fairly easy to follow. You have to shoot the other guy.
That's what I've heard.
I'm not very good at that, but no, I do know that much.
I wouldn't know. Yeah, I entered that little event that I described, and I was, you know, I believe I was the first one eliminated.
Oh,
so, yeah.
Painful.
So, real quick, I know we're out of time, and you guys have been generous to kind of go a little past our time. Off topic from the tribe, have you played a game recently that you would recommend to listeners that they check out? Something that you've spent some time on that you've enjoyed?
You know, I spent
first
most.
Of, I can't think of anything.
No, it's tough. I played a bunch of games I was disappointed in this past couple months. You know, like Elemental War of Magic was such a bummer. Yeah. But I spent the entire summer playing Picross 3D, and if you haven't gotten that for your DS, what an amazing way to waste time. It is a really, really cool game. It came out at the beginning of the summer, and I literally have not taken it out of my DS for 4 months.
Wow. I love the original Picross. God, we played that forever.
Mm-hmm. But
So this is better?
Oh, I mean, the 3D game is just kind of, you know, you're scrolling around trying to like turn the thing around, trying to narrow down what this little model is. So I like it quite a bit.
What about you, Chris? Anything?
I'm struggling to think of something that really blew me away. I'm not as in love with Limbo as a lot of other people. Dragon Quest IX kind of left me cold. So, you know, every time I sort of have like 5 minutes to spare just to play a game for fun, it's, I just want to find something where I can just go in and blow things up. So every so often I still throw in Crackdown 2, which for all its flaws, is super addictive and you get to blow things up. So thumbs up there.
Hey, you know,
That or watching my son play Eats or Little Wheel again and again. Little Wheel is that adventure game. It's a flash adventure game. And if you've played it, if you're an adult, you could probably do it in about 20 minutes tops.
Yeah.
What's fun watching him is that he just plays it again and again and gets everything right. And he just finds that really satisfying to go through it again and just continue to, you know, his first few times he would struggle with a few parts and now he can just nail it. And he loves that. So it's fun to watch him do that.
He's
it's always good
runner.
To get a different. Yeah, he's exactly.
Well, I'll just recommend one. It's not actually a game, but I think it's if you're a gamer, it's so worth checking out. It's the new iPhone. It's also for iPad. It's essentially a tech demo with Epic Citadel. It's Epic's Unreal Engine running on the iPhone.
Wow.
It just blows your mind. I mean, you truly like do a double take. If you've played any iPhone games or any of these sort of portable games and you see what they've done, and granted it's a tech demo, you just kind of wander around in these environments that they've built. You can't interact with anything, you can't go in any buildings or anything, but oh my god, I cannot believe the graphical fidelity that they've achieved on this tiny little device.
Conversely, yeah. I reviewed a gaming PC. It was like a $5,000 gaming rig with three monitors and a full 3D setup, so I could play the games in 3D. And if you have $5,000 to spare, 3D gaming is really awesome. I don't think it's going to be awesome for anybody below that financial level. But when you're playing on a computer like that, I played Left 4 Dead in 3D, and it kind of changed my life. I was like, I felt like I was even more in the game. I was surprised because I've been very skeptical about 3D gaming. And I don't think, you know, on consoles it's going to be all that fun. But man, if you have an expensive rig, it looks great.
So did it convert you? Are you a believer in whenever the tech gets here, then it's affordable that we're going to be playing 3D games?
I think in 10 years when the $5,000 computer is $60 or, you know, affordable, then yeah, I mean, I think we will be playing those games, or at least, you know, choosing, having the option to, but, you know, that depends on them making computers cheaper.
Right.
And I don't know if that's really happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank both of you for chatting with me and for spending your evening with me. This has been a real delight. You guys are writing heroes of mine, and I don't mind telling you, I was going to tell you this at the beginning, but actually I thought, well, I'll just save it to the end. This is totally true. I'm not making this up. I'm teaching a freshman tutorial, which for us is kind of like how to be a college student. And part of the responsibility we have is teach them writing and discussion skills, presentation skills, writing skills, sort of the three things, and a little bit of research. The students struggle with conciseness, concise writing, clear, concise writing. This is a big, big issue with college students, beyond grammar issues and sort of basic writing stuff that they don't get in high school. It's just how to say something clearly. And I've been using both of your work to demonstrate to them what good, concise writing looks like. And anybody listening to this show, seriously, I've given you, you know, outlets that you can check out the writing for both Chris and Gus, and I'll put them in the show notes. But you guys are terrific writers, that's never been more clear to me than this past week when we've really been, you know, in a kind of classroom setting looking at your work and the work of a few other people.
Whoa. That's very kind. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's an honor.
Craftsmanship is a good thing. We don't talk about that at all with writing. We talk about, like, how do you write about games, and, you know, should it be about experiential stuff or should you do analysis? But we actually don't talk very much about writing itself. And I know, Chris, you're editing a lot, so you must think about it a lot. But, you know, what good writers do to communicate what they want to say about a game. We're really not very good at that. if you read broadly, you know, in the sort of game space, there's a lot of pretty horrible writing out there. So
we're indebted to editors like Chris, I think, honestly, because having people who are willing to go the extra mile and sit down and help you rewrite, help you clarify, that's how we learn, you know. And a lot of times in games, you know, we could just type it and post it, and that's good enough. But you know, people like Chris who care to go that extra mile really makes, I think, a difference in the quality.
Well, that's very kind. I do actually really love editing for that reason, though, that there aren't, it seems like, especially in the games press, there aren't a lot of people who love editing and just really want to wrangle with copy. And it's, so it almost feels like this opportunity. And at the same time, it's easy to, you know, an issue of Killstream comes out, and if I'd written the whole thing, I wouldn't really talk it up, because I'd be like, oh, you know, I wrote this. I don't know, maybe it's good. But like when other people write it, I can just brag about it, because it's like working with all these wonderful writers, all the wonderful stories that are in there, and I could just talk it up all day long.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. It's sort of like whatever they brought was wonderful, and maybe I helped bring that out in it. But it's like at the end of the day, it's like, oh, you got to read this stuff. And we had time to make it this good. It's so wonderful.
Well, thanks again, guys. And we'll be seeing you, I guess, when will be the next time? Maybe GDC will.
Yeah, probably.
So, yeah. It's a while.
All right. Well, thanks again, guys, and happy gaming.
Thank you.
Thank you.